Oh, let me start with that. Okay, a big apology. I gave you the wrong key initially, so I had to rename everybody's paper. So some of you were really puzzled about how your animal changed, you know, from one part of the assignment to the other. Suddenly you have a different animal. So that's why that is. So I'm sorry about that. You should have been able to find your paper and comments, and you should have been able to look at anybody else's paper and comments. And I want to start the second half of the course by recommending this. If you would to consider it, look at some more papers. Looking at other people's papers can be very helpful in thinking about how to get better at doing this. Philosophy is not an easy thing to do. You know, you can do it relatively better or relatively worse. But, you know, and so I still don't know whose paper is whose, really. You know, it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is to help you become better philosophers. And in that process, I think there's room for some anonymity and some non-anonymity. So you're always welcome to come see me about your papers as you're working on them. And you're also welcome to come see me about your papers now, because we're getting ready to do more work. And looking back at the paper and kind of figuring out how to make it better, figuring out what you did well so you can do that again, those are all really useful things to do. And so listening to comments on other people's papers might be helpful with that. Okay. Any lingering confusions about, did anybody not find their paper or not get their paper back? I have a student in the other class who's not sure my comments really were about his paper, so we need to investigate that. I mean, it's possible that that would be a mistake. Okay, are we good on that? Mm-hmm. So please, it seemed like the level was pretty good. I didn't feel like we had too many that had to be below a B minus. And so my goal is not only to make you individually better philosophers, but to get the whole class up into the B range. And that'll probably happen by the time of our final grades. I mean, it's not unusual for me to have few, if any, C's in my final grades. So we have to do it legitimately, right? We can't fake it. So there's kind of a relative judgment going on about the papers, but there's also a sense of sort of where are we on this kind of more objective scale of what college students at a really good university like Gonzaga should be doing. Okay, so anyway, come see me about your papers. I really want to talk to you about them. That's where the progress occurs in moving from one writing exercise to another. And in class, and I hope by now, there's another kind of course mechanics topic. I hope by now it is evident that reading before class, coming ready to do good work in small groups, is part of a process of articulating your ideas, and that articulation often is evident in the papers. Some of you come into the paper writing with, you know, hang on a second. I mean, we all come into these projects with different background skills and abilities, so that's all fine. But what's going to matter in the next 6 weeks is how much better we can be at being philosophers, both in class and in our work. Okay. As I was getting ready for class today, I ran across a really weird thing from last year that I'll show you. It relates to the enthusiasm you may or may not have for more quizzes. I did an anonymous tell me where I asked last year's classes how they were feeling about quizzes. And this is kind of the Rorschach. This is all the responses in one paragraph. So you can kind of see, you can find yourself in here in a second. I'd be completely fine with no more quizzes. I don't need any more quizzes. I like that one. I'm okay. I'm okay over here with no more quizzes. If that's how it goes, I'll be all right with that. You know, that's great.
Please, no more quizzes.
Please, no more quizzes. I love that one. I beg you. So, I mean, I would like to move, at the second half of the term, and this is an evolving pedagogy for me, I want your advice, obviously, about this. I'd like to move away from quizzes. I think they maybe mattered, if they mattered at all, and I'll ask your opinion about this later, maybe they mattered early on in the course. I'd still like to come up with ways of giving you credit for being engaged in the material and being on top of things, so I might do things like ask you to turn in a study question and just kind of give you credit for doing a decent job, not try to, you know, grade you severely on it. So that would be an alternative to quizzes. What happened last year, this reminded me, is that it led to a good discussion about other ways to do that. So we might try to explore some other ways that are a little bit less about remembering what you read. But it is, I think, I've had anecdotal reports from students and some survey data that, yeah, definitely from last year, that having quizzes, I asked the question this way, did having the possibility of quiz make you more likely to read for class? And I got a huge majority saying yes. So that's kind of still a kind of an important thing out there. In the competition for your attention on a day-to-day basis, this class that has you turn in something, that has a discrete evaluation, is generally going to win out. So let's try to move away from quizzes, but let's recognize that you're going to need some discipline to get ready for a class that isn't going to test you on something, okay? Because you got other classes that are. You see what I'm saying? And so it's perfectly reasonable for you to pay more attention to the things that are coming up as discrete, you know, tests and evaluations. But try not to leave your philosophy class in the ditch. And if we need to bring quizzes back, I might give you some notice. I might say, hey, I think we need to have a quiz next class, and that would be a little bit less. And so eliminating the surprise might be nice too. Am I right? All right. So anyway, that's kind of where we are mechanically, and really at this point you're ready to do more interesting writing than just answering quiz questions. So that's very time consuming sometimes, but we'll move in that direction. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to do that doesn't require as much active participation, but feel free to chime in, is I want to give you a recap of the first part of the class. Okay. And starting with reminding you that this is an ethics class, and in case you forgot. And I want to kind of just put some of the first half content back in your heads, kind of do a little upload for 10 minutes, and then I'd like to give you an idea of where we're going in the second half of the course, and then I'd like us to do some work on Chapter 5, which is a pretty important chapter for Haidt, and I think it sets up a nice small group discussion, so really related to our study question, so I think you should be able to leave today with a pretty feeling like you're back in the course, and you have an idea of where Haidt's theory is going and where the course is going, okay? So let's jump into it. Okay, so to organize the first half of the class, we could say, and this will be familiar to you could say that we learned some things about meta-ethics, we learned some things about ethical theories, and we learned, or we tried to give an ethical analysis. Okay, so let's just remind ourselves of some of the things we did under these headings. And you know whether you want to write this down or just kind of go back through your notes. This is kind of what I'm going to do, and just kind of reacquaint you with some of the concepts in the course from the first half. Okay, so you remember we started with a little bit of environmental psychology, and we have a lot of other, we ran across a lot of research in Haidt that was also in the category of environmental psychology, and that was the Ariely thing about lying and cheating, and I'm not going to be too exhaustive here, but let's just kind of, and then we got into a little bit of, you know, we got Singer's point about relativism and about universalizing. So that was the idea that everyone's happiness is equally important to them, right? Remember that got introduced, so this is the equal happiness principle. It's not quite the principle of utility, right? But this was, he was sort of saying that you're not doing ethics unless you're giving reasons and they apply universally. That was kind of that point from that early Singer essay that I still think is probably an important thing for us to remember. And then we got some developmental psychology, right? And that included things like Piaget and Kohlberg. And then we got a critique of it, right? Because Haidt isn't happy about that. And Haidt also gave us a critique of the philosophers. He said the philosophers had a kind of rationalist delusion. That should come back into our work today a little bit. And then we learned a little bit about the brain, because after all, the brain is pretty key to doing ethics. The divided self And then we started to get into some of Pipe's story about developmental psychology and anthropology. Schrader's coming back into the picture here. We got some anthropology and cultural differences, and we're going to talk about that more today, right? That's coming back into our picture. And then we started to pile up some ethical theories. We had virtue ethics. We had utilitarianism. We had Kantian thought. And we also had libertarianism. And we also had this kind of rights theory was kind of hanging out here. We're going to do a little more work on that. Kantian was seen in terms of rights, Kant's theory, but libertarians as well, right? So we had this idea that there were different models of rights that might answer the question of the nature of morals. Okay, so this is what we were doing in February. And then we started to get all of this meta-ethics on, let's say it's the elephant and the rider, right? But let's remember that that is really about automatic judgments. So we had the famous fart spray research, for example. Soul-selling, roach juice, harmless taboo violations. In other words, we started to explore the landscape of the elephant's mind, if you will, how we make these automatic judgments. And really, that set up a pretty big discussion about emotion and reason, right? So that became a pretty big theme, especially by the end when we were looking at Dewall, right, and primatology and whether ethics was continuous with our evolved moral emotions, right? And then, you know, we had Korsgaard and Singer weigh in on that, objecting. We've covered a little ground here, guys. And then we kind of made a turn toward thinking about absolute poverty. And we had the Sachs and the Singer articles there. And then we tried to give an analysis that worked for us and met some requirements there. Okay. Wow, we did some work. Good. Oh, there's the primates. The dry nose and wet nose primates. Okay, so that's kind of what we did in the first half. Now, here's where we're... Okay, questions about that? So I'll say a little bit about where we're going, right? So where we're going in part two. What's on the agenda. We're actually going to get Hike's theory now, finally. I mean, he hasn't quite given us his theory, and he's not going to quite give it today, but we're going to get a first version of it. By next week, we'll have his theory. It's called the theory of moral foundations, and I'll remind you of a little bit of it today again. So we're going to get Hite's theory out. We're going to explore the connection between personal morality and political morality. That was something I mentioned along the way, that the model of ethics I'm working from and that Hite's working from suggests that if we can explain our ethical differences, we'll also understand our political differences. It is warm in here, isn't it? Goodness, even with the window
on.
The heater's out full blast, amazing. Well, I know, it's terrible, gently, but then we get people walking down the hall in the way, so we'll get a little fresh air in here, sorry. We could relocate, but we have these groovy chairs that we don't want to give up, right? I know. Yeah, they move. Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's see. Where were we? Okay, so this is going to be, this should be very interesting. I really have enjoyed teaching the course this way. So we're going to start to broach our political differences a little bit. I hope that's something that we can start to do. Once we've got Hite's theory out, I think it'll be a little easier to see how we might enter into discussion about political difference without triggering our polarization responses without triggering some of the problems that we have in our political culture, which is that we're a highly polarized society. Is that fair to say, politically? That we had a very contentious election that divided people further, that we're in the process of, my goodness, today's news was pretty dramatic. So maybe you guys have been following the news today, right? We have now the first confirmation that, oh, there's the 6 o'clock bells. First confirmation by the FBI that they are investigating possible collusions between the Trump campaign and its representatives and Russia and tampering in the election. We had known that the government, we knew before the election that the government was investigating Russian attempts to influence the election. And so this is a pretty dramatic news day. And it reminded me, as it would remind people my age, of Watergate. And so when Watergate occurred, I was just a young little guy. It was great. I was like 12 years old. And I was very idealistic. And I thought, oh, these adults, they're fantastic. You really count on the adults, you know, because they're mature and all that. They wouldn't, like, break into offices to steal briefing books and try to win the campaign that way. And when Watergate first broke, it was the same thing as today. We didn't know if it was true. And so that uncertainty is really the main thing to focus on. I hope it's false, actually. It would be very disturbing if there was collusion. It's already disturbing that there was influence. But it feels a little bit, today feels a little bit like Watergate in the time before we understood whether it was true or not. So but the reason I bring that up is to say that we not only have a very polarized political culture, we have difficulty talking to each other across our political differences, but we're now entering into a lot of uncertainty about where things are going. So people who felt bad about the election or felt differently from each other about the election are now facing a crisis of confidence if they voted for Trump, maybe. Now there may be, I don't know what your sympathies are, if maybe you're like me and you're hoping it's not true. But this is going to complicate the effort. Now, I'm going to make a wager that Haidt's theory is going to make it easier for us to talk about political difference. That's all I want to say right now. And we'll just get into it in the next few weeks. But I hope you find that it does, because I think that's one of the biggest problems we have now, and it might not be getting better in the short term. No matter where you are on the political spectrum, the problem of polarization doesn't seem to be improving. So that's coming up in the second half of our work. We're also going to start One World Now. We start this next class, so if you don't have it, let's get it, get the book. Peter Singer, One World Now, yeah? And so this is about the ethics of globalization. So he's going to start with the claim that the two main ethical challenges facing us are terrorism and climate change. And those are both global problems. So he's going to make an argument through this book in connection with a number of global issues, not just those two, that things are different. We're in a different world. We're not in a world of international differences anymore. We're in a world that's connected in ways that our ethics has to become global. And that's an interesting argument, because we're actually experiencing politics that's pushing back against that. When you think about the populism and nationalism that characterizes both the Trump administration and political parties across Europe on the right that are pulling back, that are thinking less in terms of European community, they're thinking less in terms of multilateral agreements, they're thinking more in terms of protecting jobs, protecting national economies, you have Brexit, right? So you know this story. So we're at an interesting time to be talking about ethics of globalization, because there is there's a kind of pushback against it. And so I want us to be particularly open. Singer is going to be an advocate of an ethics of globalization. He's going to basically make the argument that things have changed in a way that makes it impossible for us to solve these ethical problems using the old models. But I want us to also be reading and posting from people who along the lines of the contemporary nationalist movements that we find in the U.S. and Europe, who would say, no, Singer's wrong. This is the problem. We shouldn't think of it this way. We should get back into our countries, take care of our people, and that'll be a better strategy. So that's an honest, there's a tension right now between ethics of globalization and nationalist politics. Okay, so that's going to be on our agenda. And then we're going to have an option to write a position paper either from the topics in this book or, depending on how you guys feel, we could choose other topics. Oops. Last year, we had topics like this. There are wiki research pages on these. They're great topics. The religious liberty topic is very hot these days. So we don't have to write our position paper on ethics of globalization. I think we'll have a good basis for that if you want to choose a topic there. But I think for our second paper, I'd like to see more diversity of topics, if that's okay. So be thinking about, you know, topics you might want to... Oh, no. Anything about topics you might want to address. So we're doing... So then the course kind of ends with position paper, too. Okay. Okay, so that's where we've been and where we're headed. I hope I didn't take too long with that. Okay, any thoughts on that? We're good? All right, let's get into chapter 5, because this is pretty interesting stuff. And again, here, if you could take the book out, one of the indicators that we don't need quizzes will be if we do these, you know, this, we're going to do something that's very familiar to you in the course. We're going to try to recollect together the main ideas in chapter 5. So one reason we wouldn't need quizzes is if we could have a pretty lively experience of this without using the quiz as a motivator. So take the book out, take the text out, come with the texts, and let's do this together. Okay. So, please, yeah, absolutely.
For the reading for Wednesday.
Ah, right. Good. Thanks.
Like, I guess, it says Singer One World Now, that book.
Good.
Chapter 1, which is pages 1 through 16, and part of chapter 2, and it says pages 16 through 68.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So are we supposed to read 16 through 68?
Oh, I don't think I corrected it completely. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
That's like 70 pages.
I know.
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I know, and I mean for you to read it all. I did change that. I was going to divide chapter 2 over two classes, but what happened, and we won't have a quiz next class, but I would like you to read both chapter 1 and chapter 2, and the reason is that it gives us it frees up an entire class, and so when I revise, you'll see a couple of other changes in the schedule. I wanted us to have a full class day later to talk about our papers, and I didn't have that in the schedule. So, yeah, do your best with that. It's pretty readable material, but that's a lot of pages to put in between a Monday and a Wednesday. I absolutely agree with you. Okay, we'll do the best we can with that, and I'll have the detailed notes on it as well. Good. Yeah, that's a good reminder, though. Everybody note the reading schedule did change a little bit, so don't go on an old printout of it if you printed it out. Okay. Okay. Yeah, other questions about anything like that? We're good. Okay. Okay, take a few minutes and get yourself into the chapter Beyond Weird Morality. Let's start by talking about what weird morality is. You know from the screen, it's the morality of Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic cultures, right? So how did this come up for Haidt? How did he come to identify people with those attributes as having a distinct morality? Does anybody remember how this started? Yeah, please.
When he was at Penn State, yeah. He noticed all the kids were having the same reaction.
Yeah, so he's doing his little dumbfounding experiments in Philadelphia, right?
Went to McDonald's down the street.
Yeah. So if you hang out in an urban neighborhood in Philadelphia at the McDonald's, and you're going to get one group of people, and if you go to University of Pennsylvania, you're going to get people like you guys, more like you guys. And what does he notice about the difference between those two groups? Yeah, please.
It just seems that that there's like this vast, the reaction that they have to it, like, is motivated by different things. Like, so the students were more likely to react saying, well, I mean, maybe it's wrong, but it's his right
Good.
To do that.
Let's get that in your notes. So the first difference is the students felt the same disgust, but they overrode their disgust with an ethic of autonomy.
Yeah.
As long as you're not hurting me, it's your business. Yeah.
And then the McDonald's people, the people that hang out in the McDonald's, they felt that disgust, but then opposed it because it was against. They opposed. I think there was a few different.
You know, one of their reactions was, "Are you kidding? Do I need to defend this?" In other words, another difference is that the non-weird morality subjects didn't feel the need to give reasons for some things. It was just wrong. I mean, if I need to give you a reason, you know, it's hopeless. So the weird morality is characterized by a kind of individualism, an emphasis on autonomy, an emphasis on rules to decide ethical issues rather than feelings, and a sense of universality, that ethics is the same everywhere. We're all trying to be autonomous individuals. So what makes something moral in one place is the same as what makes it moral in another.
Okay, I'm not kind of getting off track, but would weird morality be considered almost apathy?
You're apathetic about a lot of things. You're apathetic about social relations. Those are completely optional. Is that where you're going?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're apathetic about... But you're not apathetic about autonomy, rights, democracy. Yeah, but you're right. It's a different... let's put it this way. It's a different profile of concerns than non-weird. So non-weird could include people from a poor urban neighborhood in Philadelphia. But notice this distinction is similar to individualistic sociocentric. Remember that distinction from earlier? These aren't quite the same distinction, but they kind of cut across each other. So the weird morality person is an individualist. So they are individualist, rule-governed, and universalist. So they think morality is kind of the same everywhere, there are rules to make it clear, and that it's ultimately about being an autonomous individual and about rights. As long as you're not harming me, go ahead and do it. You know, doesn't matter what I think of it. Okay, so that's how the chapter opens, with him realizing that in his research, even within a Western environment, right, because they're all in Philadelphia, you have a cult, put it in your notes this way, you have a dramatically different meta-ethic. People are making ethical decisions in different ways, and he wants to describe that. And what he claims in the chapter is that you need Schrader's three dimensions to really describe how people make ethical decisions. So weird culture is all about autonomy, but if you're going to try to understand anybody else, you're going to need to look at community and divinity. In other words, we're focused, us Western educated, industrialized, rich Democrats, we're focused on autonomy. But when Haidt goes to India, he realizes he can't make sense of what's going on without three dimensions to the morality, which is pretty cool idea. Now this isn't his theory yet, but he's moving from Schrader to his own theory here. So before we get into that, let's just get a couple of more data points here. So one way to tag weird culture is that it's got this individualism, and that does connect with some of our East-West research on cultural differences. So could somebody For instance, could somebody remind us of the frame line task on my page 1097? But I need to give. I should give your page number here. Let's see. What was the frame? This was some research that helped explain how Western and Eastern cultures differ, right? Anybody want to do this for us? Please, yeah, thanks.
They were given like a box with a like diagonal line in it, and then on a different page they were given a bigger box with no line in it, and they were told to draw like two versions of the line, one that was relative to the new box size, and then one that was just the same size of the original line.
Good.
And they found that in more individualistic cultures,
good,
it was easy to draw the relative line because they saw it as like a distinct thing, right?
Yeah, you're doing great, but I think in the individualistic culture, so one task was to reproduce the line exactly equal, right, to the previous line, and another task was to reproduce the line proportionally to the increase or decrease in the box, right? And who did better at each of those tasks?
Didn't the individualists or like the autonomous people do better at like just reproducing the original line?
Yeah, that's right. So the point for your notes is that Westerners are better at reproducing the length of the line. Easterners are better at reproducing the relative size that the line needs to be for the new box. Does that make sense?
I was really interested about this because I was diagnosed with a learning disability,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that they have you do is this.
Interesting.
And like what they're looking for is your like ability to do this.
Yeah.
And I like could only do the second one.
Okay.
Oh,
so you were better at the relative test?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Like, when I was really little.
Okay.
Like, I could only do the other one. I couldn't do the first one.
Mm-hmm.
That
is fascinating.
That was like
I had no idea. That's
part of my diagnosis, so it's like
I mean,
severely.
You know, whether this is a generalization, right? But what your comment gets me thinking about is that, you know, we have cognitive thinking style differences that kind of that could instantiate this difference. It might not. And so, but we also have differences that show up in when we self-report, right? So they probably didn't ask you to do this, but you know, another way to see these differences is when you complete the sentence, I am, right? So how do Westerners complete that sentence versus how do Easterners complete that sentence, right? That would be it. I don't know if this would track the same thing, but, right? So a Westerner is going to say, I am trying to become an engineer, a doctor. I am, what are some of the examples from the chapter? Yeah.
He said, that Westerners find themselves as, more like things about their personality, like
right.
I'm happy, I'm like
good.
Sporty, and like Easterners would be like I'm a student, I'm like a son,
I'm a brother, a daughter, a mother, yeah. So good. So in your notes, you could say that the Westerners are more egocentric. Their reference point is themselves for identifying themselves, whereas the Easterners are more sociocentric. They think of their identity more in relational terms, which fits the line task, right? Good. So when he goes to Bhubaneswar, he has these really conflicting experiences, and this is what convinces him. This is the main point for your notes. This is what convinces him that you need all three of these. He doesn't think he could make sense of his experience in India just in terms of an ethics of autonomy. And part of that's because he's going to a sociocentric culture, so that's fairly straightforward. But let's follow his thinking on this. So what happened when he goes to India, he has some very conflicted experiences. Can we get a couple of those details out? This is how I became How I Became a Pluralist. What page is that in your books? 118. Good, thanks. He really had trouble dealing with the... what were some of his experiences there? Anybody just remind us of them? Yeah.
Well, he was was too nice to the servants.
Right.
And then the women didn't eat with the men, and he, at first, he found fault with that. Stuff about bathing in sacred waters that were visibly polluted.
Yeah, so he was, yeah, these were some of the conflicts. He was around people who were very patriarchal. He found his liberal, you know, he's a liberal, weird, he's weird himself, right? So he's feeling resistance when he sees the way women are treated. He's noticing that parts of the house are he's not allowed into. I had this experience actually when I went to Jordan to visit a friend. And he took me into his house. I was with my sons, and we had a great experience. But it was pretty clear. There were a number of things that were very clear right from the beginning. A, we were not to move beyond that room. That was like, and they were nice about it. And then we laughed about it because this was a friend, you know, and I was going to visit his father's house. And there was only one bathroom we were allowed to use. That was also made clear. And we also, none of the women talked to us. It was a men's event. And so it was all pretty strange, a similar kind of dissonance. It's like, wow, is this okay? And so, and he's also in India, he's also experiencing a culture that has a really, I've heard this is true, I've never been to India, but I've heard that it's true that India is a culture that places a tremendous value on the sacred, but has conditions that are pretty challenging in terms of hygiene and cleanliness. So you can see people bathing in a polluted river because it's a sacred river. That challenges our intuitions because we wouldn't think of a polluted river as sacred, right? So what does he do? He starts to like them. His elephant leans toward them, he says. And so he was starting to come up with ways of defending them, but also just ways of understanding them. And so he decides that, you know, what he needs is Schrader's other two dimensions. That these are people who, the point for your notes is that the people he met in India were not just working from an ethics of autonomy. You couldn't just describe their ethics in terms of whether they valued or didn't value autonomy. That didn't do the job. You had to have these other two dimensions there. And that's one of the things I want you to consider in your own small groups. I want to ask if, even in the U.S., even in your communities in the U.S., if you could understand people you know ethically by only talking about autonomy. Maybe you'll say yes. After all, you might have a social world that's weird, right? The weirder your social world, the more you can explain it in terms of autonomy, right? That's what the UPenn students were doing.
I found really interesting that after spending like a certain amount of time, he actually like started to understand it to a point where he like saw the beauty in it. So he's like, okay, this strict
right.
like moral code is like at first he was repulsed by it, but
right.
then by spending enough time with it, it was so comfortable.
Yeah, he specifically says that. He says he started to see the beauty. I can't remember how that sentence finished, but he started to see the beauty in a culture that had these other registers. It seemed richer to him. Yeah, good. Thanks.
What I also liked was he talked about like this instead of like what before he would like object first and ask questions later.
Right.
And he shifted to this more like ask questions and then. If that doesn't suffice, then, which I appreciate because
yeah.
that's how you should
yeah,
do
good.
It.
Yeah, good. I mean, think about that difference. You know, if you think you have some truths, then you might, truths about, you know, ultimate truths about the way we ought to live, then you might start by objecting. How can you let the women be silent, you know, the whole evening? That would seem like a reasonable objection to me. But if you... if you thought, well, maybe I don't understand what's going on, right? So that's the shift to asking questions, right? So maybe he comes to this conclusion that he understands them better in this light, and then when he gets back to the U.S., he says, conservatives made more sense to him. And I want to get at that as well. Somebody, yeah, Laura, you get something.
I think the huge thing, too, is, I think he, like, went about phrasing it in kind of an odd way, just, like, the lead-in towards it. Kind
yeah,
of
how?
Me a little bit, but,
okay.
He said he was committed to understanding this like alternative Eastern culture on its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's like halfway through 119.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And I feel like that was like a crucial element to it, because I mean, even though he definitely came out understanding it still with a very like Western lens,
right?
Because it's just hard to avoid that said kind of bias. I feel like he probably wouldn't have been able to come to any sort of conclusion without that, like on its own terms,
yeah.
Like experiencing it semi-naturally.
Absolutely. I mean, the experience, this experience is powerful. I mean, what he realizes is that, wow, there's something beautiful about people seeing, feeling a duty to each other, feeling connected to each other. He realizes he doesn't have that. He was brought up to think about his own resume, you know. So that's good.
When I was reading it, I kind of was thinking two things like around that same area, but I thought it was good that he noted like really clearly that he would have understood their culture differently if he had just hung out as like a tourist with other, like he would have ran into Western people and probably like made fun of
right.
it kind of.
Right, right.
But at the same time, like as I was reading it, I couldn't help but thinking like although he was pretty like critically looking at his experiences, if you were like a woman going into that
interesting
society,
right.
it would be like really like it would
right.
be hard to see it, and like obviously he's gonna start to like it, like it's like he's elevated there, like
he has status there,
yeah,
right,
exactly.
He's,
whereas
right.
if you came
he's
in
an honored
from
guest.
The West and you were white and you were female there, it would be a completely different experience, and it would
right.
be really hard to like
good point.
Understand the community behind it. So I feel like not that that's a bias, but just that it's a little bit like could be lead you to feel things that are you've never maybe felt before over here, where like the weird is so prominent and like feminism
right.
is such a big thing here, like
right.
he would never feel that way here, so
yeah.
it's like kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean we naturalize our commitment, so for us it seems very natural. For many of you, probably, it seems very natural for men and women to treat each other equally. I mean, it does to me. I mean, at least that's the goal, right? So, yeah, you go into another environment like this, and suddenly what's natural is very different. And so that's kind of that dissonance that leads him to think he needs to broaden his descriptive resources. Good. Yeah, thanks. Others? That's good. Okay, so let's see if we can kind of move toward our small group work, because I think you guys are pretty close to being... You know, maybe you're already ready to take on these questions. Let me just set this up a little bit more. The last step you need, I think, in the chapter's argument is to see how he's thinking about the ethic of divinity. And, of course, what he's thinking here is that it's a kind of hierarchy with God at the top and demons and evil at the bottom. And so God and goodness are at the top, and what he believes already from his evolutionary psychology, and we talked about this last time, is that we might have a more primitive ethic of divinity that really had to do with detecting disease and poison. A lot of foods are poisonous to humans, and diseased people, and to distinguish that from healthy people. And so we might have a register that evolved in our prehistory to distinguish these. In fact, some people think that our ability to taste bitterness is related to the ability to distinguish unhealthy foods. And of course, you needed to kind of find healthy people to mate with. And so that sense of purity kind of carries over to the divine dimension, okay? So, but here's where he gets into this conversation with this other famous psychologist, Paul Rosen, and he says, "Wow, what if this is on 103 in mine? I think this is 118 for you guys. Our theory, in brief, was that the human mind automatically perceives a kind of vertical dimension of social space running from God down through monsters, demons, and the devil." And the list of supernatural things varies from culture to culture, but you find some scale from pure to dirty. And then here's their insight, okay? And this is, in next week we're going to see how this leads to his theory. His insight was that people map, I'll put it on the board, we map new
moral issues onto this scale. So
this is a powerful structure. He's thinking with Paul Rosen. This is a powerful structure in our psychology. And it could be that just as we map God onto health and demons onto disease, so likewise, when we have new moral challenges in our life, maybe we're still using some of this, even though we don't think we are. For example, if you're an environmentalist, right, you probably have a disgust reaction to pollution. You probably think of a pristine environment as more godly and pure. Many people who adopt food diets like veganism see their diets in terms of purity over defilement. Eating meat is dirty, not eating meat is cleaner. Yeah, Laura.
I actually was curious kind of along those lines about the, I don't know, at one point he kind of is equating things that he's like, high is equal to good is equal to pure is equal to God, and then he says low is equal to bad is equal to dirty is equal to animal.
Yeah.
And I was just curious about that, like animal being the opposite of God, and like where exactly that came from, because I didn't see it happening. No, like I can understand it. I just was wondering what that.
Well, let's start with the bigger contrast. Animal might be hard to locate, but what about the contrast between high-minded and base? Does that mapping kind of make sense?
No, I get the whole mapping.
Okay.
I just didn't get that one opposite.
Yeah, I think the animal falls down here because animals don't have culture that allows them to do what we do. So I think a lot of these things are products of human culture, human food culture, human religious culture. So that would be my answer. Is that animals fall more toward the base because they don't have a concept of high-minded.
It's about culture. It's like God is like this ultimate culture.
Yeah, I mean, it would be an assumption, an implication that, yeah, you can't get this. This is a product of human culture at some basic level. Yeah. Even possibly pre-religious. This is one of the fascinating things about evolutionary psychology, is that they're suggesting that there are psychological structures in us that we kind of remap as our culture develops. Yeah, somebody else.
I was going to ask, even though God created animals, that doesn't have anything to do with where they fall on the scale. Because you think that it's since their creation.
Like, yeah, you guys are reminding me of philosophy of food now. Having God as a creator doesn't yet tell you, he creates things in a hierarchy, right? In the Christian, Judeo-Christian model. And last week, 2 weeks ago in Philosophy of Food, we were talking about biblical vegetarianism. Originally, God told the Hebrews, don't eat animals. That's above your station. So there was this sense of, the animals have blood and life, and I gave them life. You can't take that. Then later after Noah, he says, okay, go ahead and eat everything. And it's a big concession to humans, to human depravity, that God says, okay, yeah, go ahead, but don't eat the blood. Okay, now I have to finish the thought. This is what's weird. This is really interesting. So somehow, by the time you get to Christianity, we're eating God and drinking his blood. So that's kind of interesting. Anyway, that's food philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
I really want to
hear
a steak.
Yeah, it was an interesting moment in the course. I mean, I had done the reading, but it's like, so anyway, sorry, that's a big distraction. Let me get back to this. Yes.
I felt like when he said animal, he more just meant like it's seen in literature and stuff too, like, you know, people are described as acting like animalistic or
absolutely,
like barbaric or whatever, and I feel like
absolutely,
being tormented is like an adjective rather than like,
yeah,
literal noun animal.
Yeah,
like your pet kitten, like
I think that's right. If you want to take that thought even further, you could say, yeah, we even have a moral hierarchy. We do have like animals, like snakes are lower than other animals in terms of our moral hierarchy. Yeah,
I just like see it in terms of this relates back to like a religion question.
Oh, good. Tell me, yeah.
It's just that like God, like if you think this way, God created all, so it's like God versus animal as in creation. So like then creation is imperfect where God is perfect because
right,
he's uncreated.
Right.
So it's like uncreated,
gotcha,
created.
Good. Yeah, that's
perfect,
helpful.
Imperfect.
Yeah, good.
I think
those are a little more binary, right?
Yeah.
This is more like a scale, right? Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay. So we managed to cool the room down now. You don't get some random noise. Okay. Okay, let's get to our discussion point. I still need to set up a couple more things up. So they have this discussion, you know, he's talking to Rosen and they're saying, wow, maybe what's going on here is that we've got this scale and we kind of map things onto it. And we'll see next week how that leads to the moral foundations theory. Because what he's going to say, and I'm just going to give you a real quick reminder of this. I gave you this acronym last time. What he's going to say is that basically, instead of three ethics, autonomy, community, and divinity, Haidt's theory is going to be that we have five moral foundations: care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And if you got your book and you flip into the next chapter, you'll see a table. Somebody could tell me the page number that table's on. And this is where he's going to go. I'll just tell you this ahead of time, because I want to make a point. 146, yeah, so check that out. It's on page 146. And I think we're going to do it next week because we're going to start Singer on Wednesday. But the idea is that care and harm and these are all paired with opposites. But his idea is that basically liberals have a kind of two-channel morality. Weird, that is, people with a weird morality are focused on care and avoiding harm and fairness. And conservatives have a kind of five-channel morality. So conservatives are concerned about sociocentric issues like loyalty and betrayal, authority and subversion, sanctity and degradation, right? These are social, right? These are not care and harm and fairness are all kind of can all be talked about more within an ethics of autonomy. So we sometimes talk about liberals as neophilic because they like new experiences, right? So a neophilic person is somebody who likes new experiences. And so liberals are often telling us that we ought to expand the circle. Remember that phrase from before, expanding the circle of moral concern? We ought to be concerned about doing harm to the environment, doing harm to animals. You know, we liberals have a kind of progressivism that comes out of this idea that we can always make things better. Whereas conservatives might be thought of as having a richer moral foundation because they're operating on all five channels, but conservatives are a bit neophobic in the sense that they are more sensitive to the ways that change might be bad, right? So the conservative is the person who says, well, God, you can create an entitlement like that, you know, you're gonna really erode personal responsibility, right? So that's clearly in the healthcare debate right now. So the conservative, if you're trying to think about, you know, what are the commitments here? The conservative is the person who's saying, look, you know, we have these kind of social values like loyalty, authority, and sanctity, and those might be eroded if we expand the circle and take care of everybody. And so the point is that we're going to develop this more next week, but the point is that just as cultures, okay, this is the point for your note, just as cultures may have different ethics, so within a culture, individuals may be triggered by different moral concerns. I'll say that twice. Just as cultures might have different ethics of autonomy, community, and divinity that you need to describe them, likewise, within a population of people, individuals might have different focuses of concern. So the difference between a liberal and a conservative might be that the liberal's firing on two foundations, whereas the conservative is firing on five. And so we're going to get into that more later. I just want to bring it up because I want you to see that this isn't kind of where he stops. He's going to kind of develop this further from here to here. Okay, so here's the idea then. Does it make sense? I want you to ask two things in your small groups. One is, does it make sense to use all three of these ethics to describe a culture, even our own culture, right? So think about people you know in your social group. Does it make sense to say that some of them are motivated by ethics of community and divinity, or does autonomy do the job? That's the first question. And then the second question is, Haidt says that when he got back from India, he felt like he was stepping out of a matrix, you know, like the movie, The Matrix. So what does that metaphor mean? What does he mean by saying that he stepped out of the matrix? He says he saw his politics as more contingent, whereas before they seemed, his politics seemed more true and right, and now his politics feel more like just who he happens to be, this liberal atheist Jewish guy who goes to India, becomes a psychologist and goes to India. And now so there's a shift, and I'd like you to try to describe that. You might need to reference the part of the chapter where he does that. Okay, can we give that about 7 to 10 minutes, and try to come back with some results from that, from each of those two questions, okay?
Yeah.
It may be a minute, guys. Okay, guys, we can come back together. Okay, gang, let's see what we got. So good. One of the good things about you guys is it's 10 to 7 and it's like, I'm getting in the way. That's great. Yeah. Okay, gang. Let's see what we can do. Good. Sounded like a good discussion, those trying to hear them all. So I asked you to think about the necessity of having these three dimensions to describing ethics, right? So what are they necessary? And I sketched out a no and a yes argument. Maybe that matched some of your thinking. I don't know. And then we wanted to get at what is the moral matrix and what's it about? And I put up some dichotomies here. But what did you guys think? How would you know if you needed all three of these dimensions to describe your moral experience? You know, autonomy, community, and divinity. I asked you to kind of think about the people around you, too. Yeah.
I really appreciated it because it kind of reflected the fact that humans aren't really a cookie cutter kind of
good
deal.
Absolutely.
And so you might have, like, I take myself as
good
an example because I'm from Seattle, which is like a very, like, you just think liberal.
Right.
And I'm very along the line. Like, I went to an all girls high school, so everything was like super just like that. But at the same time, I'm Catholic, and like everyone around me is Catholic, and like a lot of people at this school is Catholic,
absolutely,
too.
Yeah, or religious, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So so you have like, there's just a lot of different motivations that people subscribe to,
mm-hmm.
and to just categorize it as like as just the autonomy. It's
right.
Like, it's like
good. I like what you're saying. Right.
Yeah. It's just. It's like seeing the world. You know,
right.
Like there's RGB colors. It's
yeah.
Like
yeah.
Red.
Yeah. Good. That's
and
a nice
just
metaphor.
Just seeing the world in red.
Good.
There's
I like
two
that.
Other main colors. That
yeah.
You
So, if you just said autonomy is important or not important, that would be too bivalent. And your comment reminds me that one of the unique solutions in America to liberalism, or to political liberalism, which is true because of our rights structure, not just left versus right, is that we tend to be individualists who form very strong communities. So it's very typical for Americans to have strong affiliation in a religious community that goes along with a sense of autonomy at the political level.
So
yeah.
It sounds very negative connotation, but kind of we create our own bubble.
We do create a bubble, but we're in a way, I want to put it more sympathetically, because in a way we're solving the problem of living in a very individualistic culture where there's a low level of care, right? It's all about rights. You do what you want, I'll do what I want. One solution to that problem is to form strong family units and emphasize religion, because those are very community and divinity-centered worlds. So one answer to this question would be, yeah, you need all three, because even if you just look at American culture, a lot of people are resolving the problems of an autonomous, rights-based, individualistic culture where you don't give a damn about anybody as long as they're not harming you by combining it with a strong sense of community and divinity. That's a very American solution, and you need all three for that. You don't have to go to India to see the importance of all three of these. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, on the contrary, if you just had communal and divinity, then you end up with someone who's also in a very sheltered,
good
situation.
Good point, right.
And then when they do get let out into the real world, things can get, you know,
absolutely.
They can't understand and grasp it.
Yeah, absolutely. In a lot of traditional cultures, movements toward human rights are seen as corrosive of the underlying values of the culture. And so, for instance, in India, there are laws prohibiting people from degrading other people's religions because they're likely to come to violence over that. And so these are so strong that it's hard to admit free speech as a rights-based value because it seems like it's going to... Right. Yep. Laura,
at the same
time,
I think... Like him bringing this up, I don't think he did this very well because maybe it's not something that he personally feels or realizes as much. But like India has a huge amount of autonomy within their culture as well. And I feel like it's a good way of kind of recognizing your bias when you're not seeing one of those things within the culture.
Right.
Because you might be, I don't know, I feel like Americans, especially because India is this like well-known, very colonized country.
Mm-hmm.
That was so long seen through a very British perspective of like this special nation and it's like a holiday spot and all this kind of stuff, that community and divinity is so widely shared, whereas autonomy exists like not equally at all in their culture, but in a different way, and not seeing that,
mm-hmm,
is not seeing their whole culture. So it's like a
right.
good way of kind of being like, am I seeing this folk culture?
Absolutely. So we need all three because there's a holism that you don't get otherwise. Good. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
I was just going to say kind of a different example that I was thinking about, just remembering back from, like, American history
sure.
classes.
Good.
Like, when immigrants first started coming to America, they're most, like, the way they segregated themselves the most into communities
point.
Was
right.
by religion. And, like...
Right.
It's interesting because the reason they came to America was for independence,
right,
like,
right,
have their
right,
own rights,
right,
but they
very good.
Still, like, when they came, like, they didn't have any connections to anyone besides people of their religion, even
right.
if they spoke different languages, they
right.
actually, like, affiliated more by religion than,
right.
like, even their
absolutely.
Culture, like, being Irish or being British,
absolutely.
Like, they,
yeah.
or being English, like, they associated by that, and so that kind of was, like, a combination
right.
of all of them.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so if you look at American experience, both ethnically and religiously, that you'd need all three. So that's good. Those are good comments for kind of giving the yes answer. I approached it in a slightly different way, but I think compatible with what you guys are saying. I thought, well, okay, you don't need all three if autonomy is the truth. And that's the way philosophers sometimes talk. Think about Singer. Think about Korsgaard talking about how really you don't get real ethics until you're thinking about a principle-based individualistic ethics that values individuals as autonomous. So if you think that's the truth, and that the older, more traditional ways of thinking about commitment by community and emotions, remember DeWall, then you might think that that's atavistic or vestigial. It's like, oh, maybe that's in our past, but real ethics is about being rational and thinking about people as bearers of rights. But there's reason to question that. I'm not sure about that. So the yes answer would be, yeah, if our evolutionary psychology is still there and it's functional, and you guys were giving examples of immigrant communities, for example, where that's still very functional, and we'll see other evidence of that. Real quick, just give me 2 minutes of your attention. We'll kind of do this one, because I think this is an important point, too. The moral matrix is, and then so you also get this in your notes as an answer to the study question. The moral matrix, right, remember the movie is about a big appearance reality distinction, right? There's the matrix, and then he takes the pill, and he's out, right? So there's an appearances and reality. And so what I think he's saying is, he stepped out of the moral matrix because he got outside it. When you're inside your head, you think your moral positions are the truth. And so from the perspective of the first person, right, from the perspective of the first person, ethics looks like it's about truth. But from the perspective of the third person, if you're looking at humans as a population, then ethics is more like eye color. It's more like this is what I mean by population phenomenon. In every human population, there will be a distribution of people with blue eyes and brown eyes, and there'll be a distribution of people who are neophilic and neophobic, who feel more sociocentric, more pulled toward divinity and community, who feel more of a pull toward autonomy, they're more irrational, they're less empathetic. So the point is that both seem to be true, but it's a really unusual thing that we would have such a different way of thinking about ethics from our first person perspective, from which we believe in our values, right? If you're a conservative, then you really believe that terrorism is a serious problem and we need to kind of protect the borders and circle the wagons. But when you look in a population of people, you'll find a distribution of traits. You'll find that some people believe that. Some people believe we need to, this is the time to welcome immigrants and be pan-religious. You know, there's all kinds of traits that distribute themselves there. So that's what the matrix is. And this is going to stay with us because that shift in perspective, the feeling we have that our politics is true and yet it's highly contingent, is what the experience that Haidt also had. I think we need to break there, but stick around if you want to ask a question. Okay, thanks for your attention. Sorry we ran up to the limit.